some questions or comments or whatever?
I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
You say, like, you know, it's how you react to what you make you angry.
Mm-hmm.
But then, but you question this thing about every feeling you have? I mean, positive ones too, like, you know, what can make you happy, you know, what can make you, whatever, you know. But you then have to think that, like, there's polar, that there's negative and there's positive. So if you don't question your happiness, then why question your negative, you know, the negative feelings?
Yeah. Okay, so if you don't question your happiness, why question the negative ones?
We're like a part of it. We're a part of an environment.
Uh-huh.
So you have to react. I mean, otherwise you might as well sit in a cave.
Mm-hmm.
You just sit in it.
You think if you sit in a cave, you're not going to react? Oh, there's a lot to react to. Go do solitary retreat sometime and you see what your mind reacts to.
But you react off the past.
Yeah, but you also get mad at the mosquito, you know, who's in front of you. Or you get mad at the, you know, the person who didn't sweep the path in front of your cave. I mean, we can get mad at anyone, anytime, anywhere. Okay? And I think, I question my positive feelings too, because I think a lot of my positive feelings are just plain out attachment and selfishness. Yeah? And so I think it's good to question it because I notice, you know, when I'm happy, why am I happy? Because people were nice to me. Okay? So if I get happy because people are nice to me, I'm setting myself up to be miserable when people are nasty to me. Okay? Because when I'm super focused around me, I set myself up for pain. It's a total setup. Okay? When I'm less attached to my own good experiences, okay, when I'm less clinging on to pleasure and struggling to get pleasure, then actually the mind is much more peaceful, much more content, and then, you know, I'm not setting myself up to be so unhappy afterwards.
Kind of follow it too. Do you believe that confrontation has to be a part of like the patients, like the people who are screaming on the paper?
Mm-hmm.
Did you say, you know, you did this to me? Because then how do you, it seems like it would be hard to like work with those people again.
Yeah. And I don't think I'll work with them again. At least not on a book. But if I can let go of my anger because I do see those people, you know, then at least I can relate to them in a pleasant way. And it might happen sometime in the future that we're able to sit down and, you know, go into it. But actually, you know, I'm not even interested in talking about it anymore. It's really kind of boring after all these years, you know. I don't think I'd even want to go into it and, you know, do who said what and who did this. Because it was so long ago, who cares, you know. But it, you know, it may happen in the future that I work on something else with this person or with these people. I might be a little bit more cautious and then build trust with them slowly. Okay? But I don't think it's fair of me to say, you did this at this time in your life, therefore the rest of my life I'm never going to talk to you or work with you or do anything. Because that's like me thinking that I know everything about somebody based on one event in their life. And that's not true. People are very complicated creatures. And it often happens that, you know, because I travel a lot, and I really see when you travel, especially, you know, in some of the third world countries, you team up with people that normally you wouldn't be friends with, but you team up with them because you need each other to as traveling companions. And you get along very well when you're traveling together. Okay? And it's actually quite amazing to see how you can become friends with people who you may not have liked in another situation, but you meet them and, you know, you both need traveling companions at that time and you get along. Mm-hmm.
If I can ask a question about what one does with this kind of understanding in relationship to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a specific situation. I was part of a reading group about a month ago. The group had read Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower, which you may or may not be familiar with. It's a recounting of a particular story that seems to be genuinely autobiographical that happened to him during the time of the Holocaust, in which a dying SS man had asked him for forgiveness.
Oh, I heard about that.
And the question that the book raises is, what would you have done? Would you have forgiven or not? The variety of opinions is as broad a spectrum as you could wish. Most people are pretty much convinced that they can't tell other people whether they ought to forgive or not. That came up over and over again. But I did notice that the only one of those reactions in the book which focused on your focus of attention, that is, what refusing to forgive does to us rather than anybody else, the only one who focused on that was His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And that short response of his, in which he said, well, of course I forgive, because it does terrible things to you if you refuse to forgive, was the only response that was widely disapproved of by the group as being old and unfeeling. All right, now here's the question.
Forgiving is being cold and unfeeling?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Because he wasn't dealing with the same mess everybody else was dealing with. He was not, his passions were not aroused. His deep, aching sympathies were not aroused or expressed. He seemed to be as unengaged as Socrates as his own trial. My question is this. How does one go about in a world which does not believe what you've just talked about and what I believe too? How does one go about talking to other people about this? The only alternative would seem to be keeping one's silence, except when one is preaching to the choir. In which case, the wisdom that you have is not reaching anybody, it isn't going.
Okay, so how do you talk about this to other people? You open your mouth. You know? I mean, that's what you do. And it's not necessarily preaching to the choir. I don't assume that everybody in this room walked into this room as part of the choir, you know. And I don't assume that everybody's taking this talk and just, you know, taking it like chocolate milk and saying, yum. You know, I imagine it's pushing some buttons and it's reacting. And, I mean, I go to different conferences and I talk like this all the time. I think the key is that we just express what we believe and we give the other person space to believe it or not believe it. You know, I'm not forcing anybody to believe anything, but I'm not keeping what I feel hidden either. And there it is. And I just look at it as planting seeds. You know? You express this kind of view, and some people are like, oh, how can you say that? But then they go home, and like something's, there's some seed in there. And after a while, that seed might germinate. Because somebody, I mean, I don't take it for granted that in all my lives I thought like this. I probably was just as violent and close-minded as anybody else in previous lives. But somehow somebody talked to me. Yeah. I mean, even this life, believe me, I was no angel. But it's, you know, because of the power of words, then, you know, people plant seeds. We plant seeds in each other's minds.
Meditation, you know, about a year ago. And after the Dharma talk, the reverend had said, the sensei had said, okay, well, my sensei used to say, well, go get lost. You know? when he dismissed after the Dharma talk, he basically told everybody to go get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't, and it, you know, stuck in my head, but I couldn't really, you know, understand what that meant until, like, tonight coming here, and basically just it dawned on me that maybe, you know, to get lost from that story making
exactly.
of our perceptions of everything that we see out there, that, you know, it's like, it's just like, you know, just in life, dude, when I'm driving down the street, I already got, like, a movie. You know, five different movies. Like,
yeah.
You know,
uh-huh.
Like, so,
yeah.
I don't know. I was
yeah.
You know, just like that glimpse. That's how it's been working, you know. It's just like, you know, when I heard that a year ago and then right now, it kind of
mm-hmm.
came together a little
piece. Well, this is exactly an example of somebody planting a seed. And then you hear something else and you go, ah, that's what it meant. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was something I had to say when I was trying to disassociate myself from my anger and not take it so personally. I feel very disconnected from my world at that point. I feel like mm-hmm. I don't know where I stand in the midst of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very well.
What do you mean disassociate from your anger?
Like,
what are you doing?
I don't want to plug into the same story anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to impose my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know where I stand anymore. I don't know how it's going to work out and even where I should go. And I feel very lost, very alone.
Yeah.
And that's a very frightening feeling for me. It almost makes me not want to.
Okay. Okay, so feeling like a little bit like if you're not involved in your anger and you're not involved in the story, then you don't know who you are.
Exactly.
Well, we make big identities out of our traumas, you know, don't we? It's like, I'm sure we can all think of, I mean, how do we introduce ourselves to other people? You know, first we tell them, you know, we put on this nice face. And then we start telling them all of our problems. Don't we? And all the mean, nasty things, you know. And like, I'm, because, you know, my mother did this, and my father did this, and my pet dog did this, and my boss did this, and my teachers did this. And, you know, and we tell all of our stories of how, all the painful things that we've done. And we identify so much with these stories. And it's like when we start to forgive sometimes and start to let go, it's like, well, what am I going to say to everybody anymore? You know, it's like, I can't say I'm the abused child of so-and-so or I'm the, you know, neglected person that, you know, my spouse cheated on, or I'm the person who was deceived by this group of people, or, you know, it's like, I don't know who I am anymore if I let go of my anger. But that's kind of nice, isn't it? I mean, because creating an identity out of anger is creating an identity of pain. Isn't it? I mean, it's familiar. It's very familiar. There's something so comforting about our pain because we know how it feels. And when we rerun our videos, we know the end of the story. It's so secure. Poor me. Yeah? But then who wants to stay in that rut our whole lives? Okay? So at the beginning, it does feel a little bit weird. It's like, I don't know who I'm going to present myself as because my identity isn't as, you know, this negative identity of being this hurt, traumatized, whatever. Okay? So I think what's very good at that point is to replace it with a kind heart. You know, and like His Holiness says, my religion is kindness. And so, you know, instead of making up all the stories about how rotten people have been to us, is to spend our time thinking about all the kindness that we've received from others and all the benefit and all the things that they've done to help us and how we've benefited from strangers and, you know, how even we've benefited from people who have hurt us because they've made us find resources in ourselves that we didn't know we had. And, you know, and train our mind to think thoughts like this. And then, you know, our identity becomes, and, you know, we don't have this identity of, I am, you know. But what we talk about, what we think about is kindness. Right? I mean, like when you meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he doesn't sit there and go, when I was 15, they made me become, governor of Tibet. Can you imagine that? At age 15, could you have assumed, you know, complete power of your country? Look what these people did to me. I was a kid. They took my childhood away from me. You know, the country's getting invaded by communists. They're getting invaded by British. They deprived me of my childhood, made me become leader of the country. You know, and then when I was 24, there was this explosive uprising, and I had to disguise myself as a soldier. Can you believe that? They made me, a Buddhist monk, dress up in a soldier's uniform so I could escape, and I had to hide in the bottom of this truck and go over the Himalayan mountains, you know, with the snow and the ice and the cold, and I go down into India, and nobody even had a big reception for me with a cup of tea waiting. You know? I mean, I'm the Dalai Lama, and look what I've suffered, and I've been a refugee for deprived of my country for over 40 years, and, you know, the communists are calling me all sorts of names, and, you know, I'm just really a good guy trying to work for the world, and all they do is call me names. I mean, I've never seen His Holiness do that. Okay, but if I had been His Holiness, you know what you would have done, you know? Yeah. I mean, so this shows the power of Dharma practice. It does. I mean, look, because he practices, then he's, I mean, talk about people who have had traumas and tragedies in their life. He's A number one. But you meet him and he's happy, you know? And so it shows the power of practicing the Dharma and transforming the mind. Next time I see His Holiness, he'll probably go, oh! Because I always used to tell the story when I taught about His Holiness and how he's totally, whoever he's with, he's 100% with that person. You know, he's not looking at his watch. He's not scratching his head. He's not yawning. You know, it's like whoever he's with, he's like 100% with them. So to me, this is like a sign of somebody who's, you know, a spiritually realized person. So I often used to talk about this. And then last time I went to see His Holiness, he was sitting there, and he just yawned! And I almost burst out laughing. I can't tell that story anymore! And you're yawning with me! There's a couple of questions from last night that I should probably address. One of them is somebody asked about evil. Is there evil? Okay. From a Buddhist viewpoint, there are inappropriate and negative actions, but people are not evil. Okay. Why aren't people evil? Because everybody has the Buddha nature. Everybody has the potential to become a fully enlightened Buddha. Okay, so there is not a human being who is evil. So, sorry, we can't, you know, say Osama bin Laden is evil and throw him in the garbage, you know, or put George Bush, you know, throw him in the garbage. I mean, people do mistaken actions, but everybody has the potential to become
evil. So there aren't evil actions then?
There are harmful actions.
Okay.
But for me, the word evil is so loaded.
I know it is.
It's such a loaded word that I prefer not to use it. There are harmful actions. And when people do harmful actions to others, they create incredible negative karma which brings suffering upon themselves. So harmful means not only to somebody else, but also to ourselves. Okay? Then somebody else asked me to tell my story. That's why I say this for the end, you know, the best of all, because I get to talk about myself. Actually, you asked about what it meant to be a nun, huh? Okay. It's very different from Catholic nuns. Is Cleveland a very Catholic city?
Very.
Yeah, it is? Okay. So it's quite different from Catholic nuns. We don't have orders, you know, I mean, in Catholicism, you're part of a teaching order or a contemplative order, and you just do that for your whole life. In Buddhism, it's not like that. We take our precepts and our vows, and as long as we keep them, we can do anything else in our life that we want to, as long as we follow our precepts. So our main precepts are not to kill, okay, not to steal, you know, we're celibate, not to lie, especially about spiritual attainments, no intoxicants, okay. Then we have a bunch of vows about not accusing people, other Sangha members, of breaking their precepts when they haven't. We have different precepts regarding, you know, shaving our head and wearing our robes and how we get our clothes, how we get our food, how we get our requisites for life. There's a lot of precepts about that and about regulating so that we have a simple life, you know, without accumulating a lot of stuff. No jewelry or ornaments, perfumes, singing, dancing, playing music, you know, entertainment, this kind of stuff. So when we take the vows, I mean, first of all, to take the vows, you have to have the aspiration, and it's your own choice. Nobody forces you into it. In fact, in my case, a lot of people tried to talk me out of it. Yeah? You're going to become a what? You know? You graduated Phi Beta Kappa, and you're going to become a what? You know? And we work so hard, and you're going to go live in Nepal without any flush toilets? Now, are you absolutely nuts? So in my case, everybody tried to talk me out of it. But I'm stubborn. So you go to your teacher, and you request permission to ordain. In my case, my teacher made me wait about a year and a half, which I think was very good. You know, I didn't want to wait. I wanted to ordain right away, but he made me wait, and it was really good because I had to check it out and really see if this is what I wanted to do. And then there's a ceremony in which you take your vows, and you're trying very hard to keep your robes on when you're taking your vows, because our robes, I mean, mine is a little bit, I cheated now, but generally they don't have elastic or buttons or snaps. It's just one circular piece of material that you fold in different pleats and tie a belt around, and when you first put it on, you're sure it's going to fall off, you know, because it's all this material. And then you have more material, you know, you have this, but we usually wear a longer one, you know, when we ordain, so it's twice as long, and you have all this material all over the place. And you have to do these three bows, and, you know, it feels like you're just going to drown in cloth, or it's all going to fall off, and you can just stand there going, ah. Okay. But, you know, in my case, I was ordained by Kabje Ling Rinpoche, who's the senior tutor for the Dalai Lama. He subsequently passed away, and he's now 17 years old. It's very nice knowing people in two lifetimes, you know. And, how it is. The situation for Western monastics is quite different than it is for Tibetan monastics, because even though the Tibetans are refugees, they have monasteries to go to. You get ordained and you go live in a monastery and you get some kind of support. Westerners don't have any support. It's like we're ordained and you're supposed to somehow, you know, not work and do your Dharma practice but have money enough to live. It's totally contradictory, you know. So it's a very difficult situation that many people are in. And so this is one reason, actually, why I wanted to start an abbey. And so many of you may have seen the photos and the posters along the wall, and there's also some brochures. Because it's quite difficult for Western monastics, you know. We really need a place to live and to train and where we can have support. Because how are you going to do your spiritual practice if you have to, you know, put on lay clothes and go work in a job? You can't, you know. And I know for myself, I just vowed when I got ordained that I was never going to work for money, and that's it, no matter how poor I was. And I was really poor. I mean, I had to ration my toilet paper. I was that poor, and I'm not joking, you know. It's like I was in India with $50, and that was it. And even later, living in the West, in France, you know, I couldn't have heat in my room because I didn't have the money to pay for the heat. So you know, I want to establish a place where people can come and, you know, train as monastics and get good training, get a good education, and not have to worry about their requisites and learn to live a simple life. And the purpose of the abbey, you know, it's not just serving the monastics, but it's also a place where everybody else can come. You know, when you're totally burnt out from the city and you want to come and live with a spiritual community, then and stay in nature, then you come and stay in the abbey. We'll build a guest house. You can come and stay for a weekend or a week or a month or whatever you like, or come and do some retreats. And then also by having an abbey and having people who are studying and practicing really intensely, it's going to be a way to provide more teachers, because we need more Western teachers in this country. I mean, there's such a shortage, and the few of us that are, you know, it's like we're traveling all over. Even Rinpoche, you look how much he travels, because there's a shortage of teachers. So if you have a monastery, people are getting this kind of training, you're going to have more teachers, which will be much better for everybody else. Okay. And the thing about a monastic life is that our life is one of generosity. It's like, I don't charge for anything I do. And, you know, I hope people will support me. I've managed to live 26 years now as a nun, and I haven't had a job. Okay. But it gives me the freedom to do prison work. It gives me the freedom to come here and teach. You know, because if I had a job, I couldn't come here and teach. I couldn't go to the prison. You know, so it gives the freedom to really be of service. Yeah. And then it's a neat way to live, actually, because it's like you just say, everything I do, I give away free, and that's it. And then you know, people give back and people reciprocate. So you're in this position of, somebody once called it an economy of generosity. Isn't that neat? You know, where it's just everybody's being generous because everybody has a generous heart. And I think that's really the beauty of how the Buddha set up the Buddhist community, is to encourage all of us to be generous because we feel good when we're generous. You know, and whether we give money or whether we give our service or our time or, you know, our help, whatever it is to create this attitude of generosity in which we share with everybody. Okay? So we all share in our own individual ways. Yeah? But it's a way of practicing where you share. And part of generosity is learning to receive. You know, have you ever noticed sometimes how difficult it is to receive? And people give you stuff, and part of your mind goes, I don't deserve it, or, you know, you can't give it to me, or, you know, I'm going to feel obligated, or whatever. So, you know, as a monastic, we have to start to overcome all of that stuff, because we're completely dependent on people's generosity. And so to learn to accept people's generosity, and to learn to give our generosity. So that's a little bit about our life as monastics. Okay. The situation with Srivasti Abbey right now is I'm moving to Boise on Wednesday. I've been living in St. Louis, and I'm going to move to Boise. And we're looking at land. The photos that you see on the wall there, that's one piece of land that we're seriously considering. It's up in the Cascade area, about an hour and a half north of Boise. It is so gorgeous up there. I just went up there to do a month retreat in the winter. It's so beautiful. So we're really looking very intently at this piece of land and considering it. And if we don't get this, we're going to look at other pieces in Idaho, because there's just this wide openness and it's healthy and you're all invited. Okay.
I was going to ask you about your book, Choosing Simplicity. That's the one
mm-hmm.
you were able to get.
Ah.
That
talks about the nun's vows, you know, and about the monastic lifestyle. And it's what's very interesting. You weren't able to get that. Snow Lion was out?
Snow Lion didn't have it.
Really? Wow.
Well, we can have it if people would like to get it and order it. So
yeah.
I'd like to mention that that's available.
Yeah. Because, you know, if you're really interested to know about the monastic life, this book, it was some talks that a Chinese nun gave to us Western nuns at a program we had in Bulgaria in 1996. And she told all the stories behind the vows that we have, because when the Buddha started the monastic order, he didn't start it with vows, you know. When he started, it was just, you know, come monk, come nun. That was your ordination. That was it. But then some of the monks and nuns were naughty, and then people complained to the Buddha. And so that's how the vows got made, when people made mistakes. So in this book, she tells a lot of the stories about what people did that brought about the vows. And so it's quite interesting.
Why do
we have more vows than the monks? Because we had to take the vows, most of which are from the naughty things the monks did. plus the naughty things the nuns did. But the monks didn't have to take the vows from the naughty things the nuns did. Yeah, so that's why we have more. Yeah?
The master vows and that, because you was like a lifelong, once you do that,
yeah.
A lifelong thing. That's a friend of mine, a child who was from Thailand.
Yeah.
He mentioned this at all boys. And for some period of time, every month.
Yeah.
Or if it's out of respect to them. Could you explain a little bit what the difference is? And they also have monks that have worked their entire life.
Yeah.
And that, but could you explain the difference between what you treat as a life as a, their life, and those who do it, I guess, as
short-term ordination. Yeah, in Thailand they do have this thing of short-term ordination, and it's a custom among Buddhist families, you know, for all the boys to be ordained for 6 weeks or 3 months or something like that, because they say that it gives them the opportunity to create a lot of virtue, you know, which brings happy results, and it teaches them some discipline. And it, you know, activates their spirituality. So they have it organized in Thailand where you can take ordination temporarily like that. In the Tibetan tradition, you know, when you take your vows, you have to have the intention.